Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. The state of California has just been granted a third extension on the deadline to comply with a federal court mandate regarding overcrowding in the state's prisons. California has been ordered to reduce its prison population by almost 10,000 inmates. As of this latest extension, the state now has until February of 2014 to accomplish that goal. The prison law office, which brought the suit, says there are about 50% more prisoners in the prisons than they were designed to hold. Some prisons are operating at 170% of their design capacity today. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation says they've reduced their numbers by 25,000 inmates over the last 2 years, and cutting 10,000 more is no small task. So the question we're taking on is, how can we safely reduce prison overcrowding? What is the best way to do that? Governor Jerry Brown has suggested moving inmates into private prison facilities and into county jails. Out-of-state transfers are also a possibility. But groups like Californians United for a Responsible Budget say other strategies would be more humane for prisoners and better for California's economy. Some of those solutions include expanding good time credit, paroling elderly prisoners, increasing medical paroles and compassionate release, and allowing mothers who are primary caregivers to complete the ends of their sentences in a community facility with their children. With all of these ideas on the table, what do you think is the best way for California to deal with prison overcrowding? What's at stake, and how does it affect all of us? Joining us for this discussion, we've got Diana Zuniga, who's the statewide organizer for Californians United for a Responsible Budget, or CURB. CURB is a broad-based coalition of over 50 organizations seeking to stop the construction of prisons and jails throughout the state, reduce the number of people in prison and jail through sentencing reform, and divert those funds into community alternatives to incarceration. Hi, Diana.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. We're also joined by Jeffrey Callison, who's press secretary at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Prior to joining the CDCR, he was a longtime journalist, mainly at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, where he was a reporter, news director, and talk show host. And he joins us from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Holly. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We've also got David Ball on the line. He's an assistant professor of law at Santa Clara University, and he works primarily in the field of criminal justice, writing and teaching about criminal law, criminal procedure, sentencing, and corrections. He's currently the co-chair of the Corrections Committee of the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section. Hi, David. You there with us?
Sorry, I don't know why you couldn't hear me. Hi.
You're good. We've got you. So let me start actually with Jeffrey, and I'll give out the number to invite our listeners to join this conversation. But Jeffrey, since you're with the CDCR, in 2009, federal judges ruled that the state-run prisons in California were so overcrowded that they had to reduce their numbers. It was deemed unconstitutional. The Supreme Court upheld that ruling, and they went so far as to point out that prisons were still so overcrowded that at least one inmate was dying needlessly every 6 or 7 days. So you are under order to reduce the prison population by another nearly 10,000 inmates. How is the CDCR planning to do that? What's Governor Brown's plan?
Well, there's no question that there was a big problem. There were many big problems in the prison system several years ago, and that was what ultimately led to the federal court cases. And since Governor Brown took office in 2011, he basically led the effort to reduce the prison population significantly. And that process is known as realignment, or by the bill number AB 109, and that took effect in October 2011. It basically ended up reducing the prison population by about 24,000-25,000. And that is a very significant change in the prison system. It's also had a significant impact on local criminal justice agencies. However, it did not get the state's prison population to 137.5% of design capacity. I know that sounds like an odd number, but that's what the federal court ordered the state prison system's population to get down to, the design capacity being considered as one inmate per cell. And if you're at 137.5% of that capacity, below that, then the federal courts will consider us to be not overcrowded.
Which is what, 120,000? What would that number be?
Well, it's just over 112,000 inmates. For a long time, it was 110,000. That's because our design capacity was based on 33 prisons. But in July of this year, we opened a prison healthcare facility in Stockton, and that raised our design capacity. So we're now at about 112,000+, would be 137.5% of design capacity. At this point in our prison system in California, we have just over 120,000 inmates. So we're about 8,000 above that capacity that's been ordered by the court.
And can you explain how realignment is working and why is it better to shift the prison population to county jails? What's the effect on the counties?
Well, realignment was a long overdue sentencing reform, actually. And there was a lot of support in California for a change like this for many years, but it only happened in 2011. What realignment did was say that from October 1st, 2011 on, if you were found guilty of a low-level offense, a non-violent, non-serious, non-sex offense felony, you would be sent to county jail or some other form of local supervision. In the past, many of those offenders actually were sent to prison, maybe just for a sentence as short as 3 months. This made no sense at all because a lot of these were lower-level offenders. When you keep people closer to their home community in jail, there's a better chance that they'll be rehabilitated. It also keeps them out of the prison system where, of course, you have a lot of murderers, rapists, kidnappers, and so on, validated gang members. It just makes a lot of sense to keep lower-level offenders out of the state prison system and in the county jail system or in other forms of county supervision. Now, that redirection, no one was transferred out of the prisons because of realignment. It just changed where people started to serve the sentence in October 2011. And that had a huge impact on the prison population. It's reduced it by about 24 to 25,000. However, this is an important part of it. Realignment has plateaued. It actually plateaued a long time ago because pretty much everyone who's committing a low-level offense has now been redirected to jail instead of prison. So it's not having an impact anymore on the state prison population.
All right, so now let's get into how the CDCR and Governor Jerry Brown are planning to solve the problem of having to reduce the California prison population by another 8,000 inmates. Is the plan mainly to shift inmates to private facilities the top of the list for the governor?
No. No, that's not, well, it's part of it.
Okay, give us a sense of the plan.
Sure. Well, here's what the plan is. And the plan, it's worth noting, was approved on an almost unanimous and bipartisan basis by the state legislature in September and then signed promptly by Governor Brown. And it does several things. It immediately reduces the prison population by transferring around 2,500 inmates to leased beds in community correctional facilities. Those are private correctional facilities inside the state of California. It would also direct the savings from not sending more inmates out of state into a new fund that would help reduce recidivism by improving rehabilitation programs and would permanently increase the size of that fund starting next fiscal year. And the plan also calls for immediately starting to work with local and state elected officials to develop plans for other durable ways to further reduce the prison population. Now, if the three-judge court, that's the panel of federal judges who are overseeing the prison crowding case, if they did not accept that plan, then the state was willing to send thousands more inmates to out-of-state facilities in order to comply with the deadline, which has, as you noted earlier, been moved to the end of February. The state does not want to send any inmates to out-of-state prisons. However, if that's what it takes to comply with the federal court order in a timely fashion, then that's what we'll do. Our preference, though, would be for the federal judges to accept the plan, which does include a fund and consultations going forward to improve rehabilitation.
Well, let me bring David and Diana into the conversation here. I'm wondering, maybe, David, you can tell us, do either of you know how exactly private prisons work and what's the cost effectiveness of private prisons?
Well, one of the problems with estimating cost effectiveness of private prisons is you need to look at what kinds of services they're providing for people, and also in many cases private prisons have been, there's been some allegation that they're involved in sort of cherry picking. In other words, they get to pick the inmates that they want, and so they're not taking the sort of hardest cases or the the people most in need of medical care or mental health care or things like that. So it's difficult to get a handle on exactly how much money they save. The private prisons, I think, on the other hand, would say, well, you know, we're more expensive, or studies showing that we're more expensive, you know, reflect the fact that we don't do overcrowding. I was actually just at an ABA event in San Francisco this summer, and that's what a representative from a private prison consortium said. You know, at 100% capacity, of course, the cost per prisoner is going to be more expensive than it will be at 130 or 140 or 150% capacity. I think one concern that is had in general with private prisons that's not an operation in California is that when certain long-term contracts have been signed, that there are requirements that there be a certain amount of occupancy in these facilities. So in other words, a private prison will say, well, we'll build this facility or we'll operate this facility with you, but you have to guarantee us a certain number of prisoners that will be there, and obviously that might be in the individual private prison company's best interest, but it's not necessarily in the state's best interest to guarantee a reliable supply. The idea is that, you know, we want to send people to prison because they need to go to prison, or we've deemed them necessary to go to prison, not just to protect you know, someone else's financial investment. So
and one of the concerns around that is that if you build them, they will fill up. California. Since the 1970s, the prison population grew by about 750%, I think, reaching a high of 163,000 inmates, while the state's population didn't even double. It nearly doubled during that time.
But in that sense, you know, in some ways it might make so once you build a prison that the state has built and the state is operating, there's very little you can do with it. You know, we don't turn prisons into other things. So in that sense, you know, it would, you know, you could make the argument that it would make more sense to lease out, you know, excess bed space in another state rather than invest in a sort of brick and mortar building that you're going to have, you know, for 30 or 40 years. So, but if you build it,
that's definitely the state's preference.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
That's definitely the state's preference. I mean, one way that the state could have complied with the federal court order would have been to build 8 prisons immediately starting in 2011. That would have been a gigantic cost, huge undertaking, and it would have built an enormous fixed cost for decades to come. Governor Brown had no intention of pursuing that path, which is why he pursued realignment, and why temporary contracts with private facilities, if you have to have some sort of increase in capacity, is definitely preferable than building prisons that will be run by the state for decades to come.
Well, let me bring Diana into this, because she has a whole different perspective on how to reduce the prison population that doesn't have to do with private contractors. So, Diana, what do you think is the best way to reduce California, to comply with this federal order?
Yes, I just want to piggyback off of what was just said. We also agree that if you build them, you will fill them. And what we are finding out that in the last budget cycle, about $810 million was approved to build 3 more prison facilities, 2 at Ione at the Mule Creek prison, and 1 in San Diego at the Donovan prison. And what we also saw in SB 105 is that which was the bill that was approved by the legislature around what Jeffrey was just talking about, was that they stopped the closing of Norco as well. So as these prison facilities are being built, Norco is still going to be open to continue to house people. We do not think that leasing out beds from in-state private facilities, keeping Norco open, or building 2-3 more prison facilities is the answer to relieve our overcrowding issue and meet the court order. And to top it off, we also know that much of the money that is going into these construction proposals and these expansion proposals is the exact money that the voters approved in Prop 30 this past year, which was said to be an education tax, and is instead a good portion of it going into prison expansion. We really believe that the only sustainable solution...
Yeah, I'll get you. Go ahead, Diana. The only sustainable solution, and we're going to get into actually all the sustainable solutions in just a sec. Let me let Jeffrey respond to that last
I just wanted to add some context to Diana's point there about these new facilities that are actually being planned. They haven't been built yet. These are actually infill projects that are planned to be built inside existing prisons and would add about 2,400 beds. And when we planned these three infill projects, they were to be counterbalanced by the closing of this old prison in Norco, which dates back to the 20s. It's a completely redundant facility, and the community there probably would prefer to have that prison returned to local use. So that was intended to be no net difference. Now, at this point, we are probably not going to be able to close Norco as we planned because the federal courts probably won't let us do it. Well, but that's not because we want to keep all those extra beds open.
Thanks,
can
Jeffrey.
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah, go ahead, David.
When we're estimating the cost of construction projects, we need to remember that people need to work in these, new facilities, and that their pensions need to be paid for, and there's upkeep, et cetera, et cetera. So the cost of building a new prison, even an infill infill beds, is not just the cost of the physical plant. There are substantial costs of operation. And I think the other thing that I'm sure Diana is going to get into is that we want to make sure that as we build new beds, we also have additional facilities for doing rehabilitation programs to make sure that when people are released, as almost all of them are, we've done things to them that make them less likely to recidivate.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about alternatives to building more prisons, to housing more people in California's prisons. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're talking about how to best reduce California's prison population. We're under a federal court order to reduce the prison population by about 8,000 inmates more. We're speaking with Jeffrey Callison. He's press secretary at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. You just heard from David Ball, who's an assistant professor of law at Santa Clara University. And we're going to hear now from Diana Zuniga, who's statewide organizer for Californians United for a Responsible Budget, also called CURB. So, Diana, you've got kind of a four-point plan that ways that inmates could be released early, freeing up space in prisons. Can you just kind of outline your ideas here?
Yes. We actually have a 36-page document with all these different strategies that could be utilized to reduce the prison population. But we have been focusing on our four priorities, which one of them is the expansion of good time credits. During the Plata Coleman case, one of the experts on the panel, Jim Austin, estimated that the expansion of good time credits using the risk assessment that CDCR uses could reduce the prison population by over 22,000 people if the expansion of good time credits was expanded.
And that means that your sentence is reduced for inmates who are behaving well. That gives people an incentive to do programs, et cetera.
Exactly. They would be incentivized for completing treatment, educational, vocational programs, and this would actually reduce their sentence by a minimal percentage. And this was, again, brought to our attention by Jim Austin, one of the experts on the panel, and was also supported by the courts and supported by Jeffrey Beard, who is now the CDCR secretary. At the time, he was a part of the expert panel.
Okay, so we're going to ask Jeffrey Callison about that in just a minute, Diana, but let's go through these other three points.
Okay. The other one is to create a parole eligibility for the elderly. Right now, there's about 15 other states in the District of Columbia that have a program similar to this, and we believe that it could reduce the population by around 13,000 people. And the last two, one of them is the expansion of medical parole. This is a smaller amount that it will impact, but it will reduce the population by about 100 people. And the last one that we're focusing on is the implementation, the full implementation and expansion of the alternative custody program, which allows women who are primary caregivers of their children to serve their sentence under some sort of community supervision with their child. When this was passed 2 years ago, they said about 4,000 women were eligible for the program. To date, only 243 have actually been given the program, and we believe that about 1,000 women could actually benefit from this program.
Well, thank you, Diana. Let's dive into that. But first, I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. We're trying to we're asking the question, how should we deal with prison overcrowding in California? Private prisons, new construction, paroling elderly inmates, more rehabilitation. What do you think is the best way to reduce California's overcrowded prisons? Our number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you're involved in the prison system in any way, what insights do you have into how California could reduce its prison population? The number again is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And if you're somebody who's spent time in a California prison, what have you observed that might inform this discussion? Do you think that there are safe ways to reduce prison overcrowding? Again, the number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. So, Jeffrey, let's talk about this idea of the expansion of good time credit, reducing sentence time for inmates who behave well and do programs, get treatment, educational, vocational, et cetera. Can we talk about that?
Sure. We can talk about any of these items in the four-point plan. We already have good time credits, just so people understand, in prison. And we already have medical parole. We already have the alternative custody program. The issue is whether or not these should be expanded.
Yeah.
And it's I need to also say that there is at this time what a process called meet and confer that the three-judge court has ordered between CDCR and the plaintiff's attorneys in this whole case. And these matters are being discussed in a confidential process as part of that meet and confer. So I need to be prudent in the way that I discuss these matters because I don't actually know what's happening in those negotiations.
So you're saying some of these topics are under negotiation right now?
Well, they've been on the table for years. The three-judge court has been pushing for expansions of these things, for the state to consider expanding these matters. And the state has looked into it and found that there are a lot fewer people who could benefit from these, who could get out of prison earlier than the court thought. And it would still leave us far short of what the court ordered our population to get down to, especially when we're talking about the alternative custody, the medical parole. We're talking about relatively small numbers of people here versus the thousands that were still off of the federal order.
Diana said that elder prison parole program could encompass as many as 13,000 inmates.
I don't know whether that is accurate or not, but the thing is, it's all very well to say, well, this is an older person, let's let them out of prison early. The challenge is that when you look at the prison system abstractly, you can say, well, hey, that guy is 65, what's he going to do? Let him out of prison early. But a lot of these people, the reason why they're elderly in prison is because they committed particularly heinous crimes when they were younger. That doesn't apply to all of them, but it does in some cases. So a lot
but
of people,
I think a lot of people would say that, you know, 30 years later, this person is a very different individual than maybe the person who committed murder back when they were 18.
And that may well be the case.
Go ahead, David, I'm going to pull you in, but we've only got about 30 seconds before the break.
Well, you know, I just thought it was interesting that we talked about AB 109 as being a sentencing reformer. That's the way Jeffrey described it. And I think one of the questions that we're going to have to ask maybe after the break is, you know, is this really, is the CDCR the place to solve the problem, or is this just the place where the problems make themselves manifest? And so maybe the issue isn't so much what we do with people in prison or to prepare them for release from prison, but diversion from prison. I'd be happy to talk about that after we take our break.
Great. That's David Ball. He's assistant professor of law at Santa Clara University and co-chair of the Corrections Committee of the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section. We're also joined by Jeffrey Callison, who's press secretary at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and Diana Zuniga, who's statewide organizer for Californians United for a Responsible Budget. They believe in alternatives to incarceration as a way to curb California's growing prison population. The number to call us is 866-798-TALK. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Thank you. program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or if you'd rather, you can send a comment or question via email. The email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, we'll look at how the Affordable Care Act is rolling out in California so far. We'll listen to your experiences with Covered California and talk about what is and is not working so far. Friday is our weekly media roundtable, where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're considering the best ways to reduce California's prison population, which is now about 120,000. Under a federal court mandate, California is required to reduce its prison population by about 8,000. More inmates. Governor Jerry Brown wants to spend $315 million over the next year to house inmates in private and county jails. Critics prefer alternatives like paroling elder prisoners. What do you think is the best way to deal with overcrowding in prisons? Are there solutions that are both humane and good for the public safety and the public purse? I'll give out the number in just a minute. We've got a full bank of callers. But David, right before the break, you started to talk about sentencing reform and how that relates to this. So I just want to give you a chance to finish that point.
Sure. So I just want to just to back up, you know, the state of California in 2001 said that it was in violation of the Eighth Amendment due to overcrowding in state prisons. Okay, so part of the issue that we're talking about is how do we meet this deadline that's coming up in 3 months, but the state knew, you know, more than 10 years ago that it was going to need to do something to reduce prison population. And part of the problem is that we've just never had the political will to, you know, say, well, we either need to stop sending so many people to prison or we need to start paying a lot more to house them. And so in some ways, it's, you know, I feel like this waste travels downhill, I guess I can say, is the radio-friendly way of putting that. And it's the CDCR, you know, that has the responsibility of trying to manage the population, when really it's not the CDCR who decides the policies that send people there. You know, it's statewide law that's enforced locally and charged by local district attorneys. And that's what a lot of my writing has been on about, you know, the ways in which different charging patterns and different law enforcement throughout the state have resulted in differential rates of sending people to prison.
Meaning, different counties, people are sent to prison at a higher rate.
Yes, that's correct.
Laws are selectively enforced.
If you look at from 2000 to 2009, that 10-year period, and compare Alameda County with San Bernardino County, as I did in a paper that I wrote, they have almost identical population, almost identical rates of violent crime, almost identical rates of reported property crime, and yet San Bernardino is sending around twice the number of people to prison during that time and had more, you know, from 3 to 5 times as many people in prison. Now, a lot of that has changed after realignment because you can only send violent, serious, or sex offenders to state prison. But, you know, that just goes to show you that, you know, California has a pretty expansive penal code that is enforced differently from place to place. I think, you know, no one would dispute that, you know, if you're smoking pot in Berkeley and you're smoking pot in Bakersfield, I don't think anyone would be surprised to find that, you know, those are probably treated very differently. So, you know, I think that one of the questions that we want to ask is prison the place where we really want to address the problem of prison overcrowding? Or do we want to look at things that, you know, addressing factors that make people more or less likely to end up in prison in the first place? I think that the 4-point plan that Curb is talking about, those are all very sensible things. I think, you know, we need to ensure that when people are released from prison, they have supportive housing, that they have access to drug and alcohol treatment, that, you know, we do things to make sure that they're employed. side. But the fact remains that once someone's in prison, you know, it's almost too late to do very much for them. They're out of the workforce for several years. Their housing has been disrupted. Their family relations, any pro-social networks they've had, have been disrupted. And so, you know, what kinds of things can we do to intervene earlier to make sure that people don't wind up in prison? And so that might mean, you know, focusing heavily on rehabilitation in the juvenile justice system. It might, you know, mean things like, you know, drug and alcohol treatment, supportive housing, better or more funding for other kinds of social services to take kids out of violent homes, you know, which can you know, if you're raised in a violent home, that makes you more likely to commit violent crimes, et cetera, et cetera. So, but there are more holistic discussions I think we need to have as a state, and this is a surprise we've seen coming for about 12 years about overcrowding, and so I just want to make sure that we talk about some of those other factors as well.
And let me bring in some of our callers. Ryan in San Francisco, welcome to your call. Hi, Ryan.
Hey. So I work with an organization called Mindful Schools, and they're also connected with something called the Inside Prison Project, and they basically try and teach mindfulness and self-awareness skills to both young people in at-risk situations as well as people that are currently in the prison population. And I think it's important to remember that the only difference between prisoners and people outside of prison is just the skill sets that they have, their ability to respond to, you know, when they feel angry or when they feel like they have a problem they don't know how to solve. So I think the more we can give these people resources and toolkits to manage and be aware of their internal experience, that can make a really big difference in recidivism. And that's what we've seen. That's certainly what the data shows working with these populations in terms of in-school suspensions and the number of fights that break out.
Well, thank you, Ryan. David, you touched on this, you know, talking about prevention, but for the sake of this conversation, we really are going to talk about how we can reduce this prison population now in the best, most effective, safe way. I'm kind of wondering what all of you agree on in terms of what we know about what works with regards to rehabilitation. Diana, let me start with you. Programs in prison that can actually help people with things that, like what Ryan brought up, restorative justice, for example, anger management.
I mean, I totally agree that there needs to be rehabilitative programs for people that are serving their term in prison. But the fact is we are severely overcrowded, and, you know, I know there's a lot of statistics about all of these violent offenders that are inside, but that is not the entire population. And there's a good portion of the population that can be better served in the community, which I think realignment was supposed to do in the first place. You know, I just want to say that realignment has been a problem in itself. And the fact is that we do need rehabilitative services inside prisons and jails. But we're seeing with realignment that we were trying to bring communities back or people back to their communities, but we're still locking them up and not providing the reentry services, the supportive services, and the rehabilitative services in the jails and outside in the communities. Most of the AB 109 funding is going to incarceration, mm-hmm. and now we're seeing a jail boom similar to the prison boom that happened in the 80s.
And so studies show that rehabilitation does reduce recidivism, that a lot of people that go into prison go in illiterate, without education, and without a lot of skills.
Yeah, I totally agree that it does reduce recidivism, but I also think that we are not putting as much emphasis and prioritization in money going into those programs, and we're putting more of that prioritization and money going into it.
And Diana, we can't hear you anymore, so maybe check the line. Jeffrey, what do we agree on about what works with rehabilitation, and why not pour more money into that if we know that it's working?
Well, everyone, I think, agrees that rehabilitation is a key element to the correctional process, and the state is reinvesting heavily in rehabilitation. Unfortunately, when the state started to recommit itself to rehabilitation, this was under the previous governor, Governor Schwarzenegger, that effort suffered because of the enormous budget problems facing the state of California, and all sorts of things were being cut, not just at our department, but across the state government and across the economy as a whole. Now, it's just in the last year or so, with the big population reduction that's resulted from realignment, the state is able to commit more resources, not just money, but also staff and even space to rehabilitation. The state has also committed itself to expanding what are called reentry hubs. These are places throughout the state where inmates who are about to be released from prison go to get help with writing resumes, all that sort of thing. So the state absolutely agrees that rehabilitation is important and is recommitting itself to it. But that process, unfortunately, takes quite a while to set up because a lot of it depends on contracts with outside agencies, for example, facilities in the community where people live. And that takes a while, but the state is committed to that. And that, in fact, is also part of the plan that the governor and the legislative leaders agreed to in September.
And I want to get to more callers, but David, maybe you can weigh in on this kind of quickly. And I'm wondering about determinate sentencing. I mean, that's when inmates really have no incentive to do rehabilitative services, to get job training. Go ahead.
Okay. So one thing I wanted to say is that there's a criminological term called the risk responsiveness principle, and that says that actually for some low-risk offenders, you don't really, the more you do with them, the worse off they are. So I would agree that rehabilitation works for high risk, you know, people. They should get lots and lots of services. But there's actually very compelling evidence that for low risk people, if you put them in a sort of high intensity supervision, high intensity programming, they tend to do worse. So it's important to remember that we need to tailor programs to people. You don't just throw the kitchen sink at everyone, because sometimes you can actually that can be counterproductive. I think the other thing that's important to remember when we're talking about decreasing recidivism is that the people who end up in prison have huge social deficits. So when we're talking about decreasing recidivism, we're not talking about necessarily going from 70% to zero. If we went from 70% to 60%, I think that would be just a huge win.
And we are heading that way.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so, you know, I think the one other thing that I'd like to see, you know, as an academic, and I think it's important for policy reasons, is better data management and more data openness, where we can know, oh, well, let's look at this cohort of prisoners and see what kinds of interventions they got, and did that work? Does this program actually work to reduce anger, you know, in people? Does this program actually work to get people off of drugs? And can we also then say, well, given that this program works for these type of people, can we then match up those curricula with things that are in the outside? And right now, I don't think there's nearly enough coordination from in-prison programming to out-of-prison programming. And, you know, as Jeffrey said, you know, with overcrowding, there was very little rehabilitation going on at all. People would get credit for participating in rehabilitative programming if they were just on a waiting list. And so now it's, you know, it's good that we're actually doing programming here.
Well, we lost a caller. Rodney in San Francisco says he was in the prison system for 30 years. He says we should focus on furloughs and halfway houses, programs for those who are released. It's very difficult to be out on parole, very difficult to navigate getting a job and housing from the parolees that we're in contact with just through our reporting here. So Jeffrey, can you just speak to Rodney in San Francisco saying focus on this, on the halfway houses, on reentry programs?
Yes, that absolutely is key, because many inmates are released and then they have to go somewhere. One of the principles of realignment was the advantage in keeping someone close to their home community. When someone is sent to prison, they may be sent literally hundreds of miles away from their home. So when they go back home, they may have severed their connections to their family and their friends and their previous employer. They may have been away from their home community for a long time. So helping to ease that transition back into the community is key. As I said, though, a lot of those halfway houses are run by entities that are not part of CDCR, and we need to have contracts with them. And we are setting up a lot of that as we speak. As I said, we've also set up a network of reentry hubs in the prison system to help make sure that people have the tools that they need when they get out of prison. Of course, in the end, an offender needs to be willing and able to accept that kind of help. And some, of course, don't have much interest in that, but many do.
And let's go to Gina in Sacramento. Hi, Gina. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I just wanted to comment on something that was mentioned earlier, and that was elderly parole, and that some of these elderly inmates might be less serious, and you know, maybe we should just let some of these guys out. And I would just like to say I'd be curious to know how old Charles Manson is. And while he might be an extreme example, I think that just because someone's old does not mean that they're not a threat to the community. And something else I think that's been missing in your discussion, at least as long as I've been listening, is the victim's voice. My sister was murdered, and the thought that her killer could get out earlier from prison simply because he took part in a rehabilitative program, or we're just giving him good time credit because, you know, people want to believe in the goodness of people and want to see more inmates, you know, released from prison. Just, I don't understand this mentality.
Well, Gina, let me ask you, California is under this mandate to reduce its prison population. What do you think is the best way to do that?
Well, I'm not so sure that the mandate is right. I mean, as I understand it, this order is because of mental health care and other health care in the prisons. And it seems to me that most of these inmates are getting pretty good mental and medical health care. And why we would have to let more of these inmates out is beyond me. I think they're getting better care in our prisons than they would if they were out on the streets.
Which may, in fact, be true. Well, David, why don't you and Diana respond to Gina? Yeah, go ahead, Diana.
I would actually like to respond to that. I just want to say I'm very sorry for us, first of all, and I know how difficult that could be, and I just want to say sorry, first of all. And I do just want to answer the question of the elder prisoner parole option. This would only allow people that are of a certain age to go up to the parole board, and the parole board would then make the decision whether or not they could be released. If you look at the track record of the parole board, it is less likely for them to release someone that is in there for an extremely violent crime. You know, one of the things that we've been looking at is the fact that, you know, some people that are in there for, three strikers are actually not eligible for good time credit, period. And if you look at the crimes that some people are in there for life, the sentence does not fit the crime. So I understand your concern, but this would actually allow them to go up to the parole board to see if they could be released. And at that point, the parole board would make the decision from there. So it wouldn't just be direct release.
Go ahead.
The one thing that I wanted to say is that, you know, anyone who thinks that there's pretty good care, you know, in the prison system, I would really commend that you read the findings of fact of the three-judge panel. They're very exhaustive, and you owe it to yourself to sort of check out and see. You know, the legal standard that needed to be proven was very high. And like I said, the state is not disputing the fact that the prison system is unconstitutionally overcrowded, or at least it wasn't as of 2001. So
I need to respond to that.
Well, I mean, there was a stipulation that the state entered into in 2001 that said, you know, this is what we're going to do to fix things. I mean, I understand that you're going to, you know.
That was 2001.
Yeah.
Jeffrey?
Well, yes, the findings, you're absolutely right, David, that the three-judge court did examine the quality of medical and mental health care in the prison system quite exhaustively, and they came up with findings of fact. And I'm not going to dispute the fact that there are enormous problems, serious problems with medical and mental health care in the prison system. However, it's easy and perhaps even understandable that people go, well, this is what was found in the past, and not take into account the enormous changes that have been made since then. One case that the state of California would like the three-judge court to do is to re-examine the current state of the prison system and the medical and mental health care system, because absolutely things are profoundly different today than they were when the three-judge court was convened, when they looked into this matter. The prison's population is considerably lower than it was. There have been enormous investments. And this isn't just spin. This is a fact. There's been enormous investment in upgrading the staffing, the facilities, the overall level of medical and mental health care in the California prison system. So wasn't the prison system terribly overcrowded in the past? Yes. Was medical and mental health care unacceptable? Yes. Have those things all been changed significantly by today? Absolutely.
All right, I'm going to go to more callers because we've got a lot of people who want to get in on this, and we could spend the entire hour just debating that. Helen in Newark, welcome to your call. Hi, Helen.
One thing I haven't heard is there, every people know that there are thousands of illegal aliens, or to be PC, undocumented workers that are in our jail system. Nobody talks about it. And I don't care if it's 10,000, but I worked in the court systems, and it was just like, just don't mention it. And why don't we talk about getting them out of our system? And if we don't want them in the system, why don't we charge their countries of origin for boarding care? I mean, it just seems stupid to ignore the fact, if we need room, deport these people.
Well, thank you, Helen. Let's go to Ashay in Felton. Hi, Ashay. Ashay, are you there? Yeah.
I think the primary way to lower the population in prisons is to end the war on drugs, and to just release prisoners who have primarily, I guess, nonviolent crimes. But regarding drugs, to give everybody treatment. That's my first point. The second point I had was to say, in spite of your panels and politicians and people in this country, who all these powerful people who do a lot of talking, most people of color in this country know that the prison industrial complex is the new slavery. And it's very clear. And when you upgrade the prisons, it doesn't help anybody but the warden and everybody else who's in power. And people of color get trashed and forgotten about in prisons, and you haven't dealt with that. And the racism is throughout this country. It's insidious. And that's my comment, and I'll take my answer off the air. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Ashay. Diana, do you want to address that, the fear that mass incarceration is the new slavery?
I mean, if you look at the statistics, a good percentage of the folks that are inside are, black and brown and young people. So I do want us to also think about the reforms regarding the drug war that could be implemented today. One of the last bills that didn't pass was SB 649 that would have shifted drug possession as a wobbler, so it would have been considered a misdemeanor or a felony, depending on what jurisdiction was hearing the case. This is a common sense reform that many people have cycled in and out of the system because it has been considered a felony. So we really think that this is one of the clear solutions that could help us with the jail overcrowding and with the prison overcrowding issue. And there's so many other reforms on our website that,
And we'll put a link to all of this information at yourcallradio.org. Mimi in Monterey writes, two comments. One, we're going to pay for these inmates one way or another. We can help them as children, or we can deal with them as participants in the system. I think an after-school program is cheaper than housing someone for years, cheaper than having to rehab them, cheaper than having to deal with them again when they can't find work. And two, is there possibly a way that someone with a single nonviolent offense can have that wiped so that they can actually start over? Then if they commit a crime, they have a permanent record. And I know that there are clean start programs in many counties, including San Francisco, where an inmate can attempt to get that wiped clean. But getting to the first point, David, which gets to what you were talking about dealing with some of the root causes here, one of the ironies of the prison expenses is that the more that we spend on prisons, the less we generally have to spend on education, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, so, it's just a question of oftentimes, and I've written about this too, we treat spending on criminal justice as being somehow compulsory, in a way that we don't, like poison control was sort of on the chopping block, a couple of years ago when we had, all these budget crises. And I think, that there are lots and lots of things that deserve money, and I don't know why we don't use cost-benefit analysis on criminal justice like we do with everything else. People die on the roads, but we continue to drive, and we think that the benefits of having cars outweighs the tremendous harm that comes from having cars. And so, you know, I think that, that one of the ways in which criminal justice is framed is that we should aim for 0% crime. And I don't, that's not possible. So I think we need to at some point decide, like, you know, how much harm are we willing to live with given the tremendous costs of incarceration? And moreover, how can we spend our money in a smarter direction? And so I think that these prevention programs, you know, before someone gets involved with the criminal justice system, that tends to be cheaper and also more effective.
And Jeffrey, we have just about a minute and a half before we end. Can you give us a sense of what's going to happen next between now and February?
Well, I wish I knew what the answer to that is. It does partly depend on what happens in this meet and confer process. That's the name of this process that's going on that the three-judge court ordered, and they've extended it once, and that's why the deadline to comply with the overall order has been extended to the end of February. These are confidential negotiations that are happening between the CDCR and the plaintiff's attorneys. I don't know what's being talked about in those, but the three-judge court ordered them to happen under the jurisdiction of another judge. That judge is scheduled to report back to the three-judge court with recommendations later this month. What the court does with those recommendations remains to be seen. The state believes in the plan that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor in September. We hope that the three-judge court will go along with that. If not, well, it remains to be seen what will happen. But we should have some clarity, I would expect, within a month or so.
And Diana, let me give you the last 30 seconds to let us, what should we be thinking about as we watch this? Diana, are you there? I'm going to go to David. David, you get the last 30 seconds.
Sure. You know, I mean, I think that everyone wants a negotiated solution. I think things work much better when, you know, the state who's going to be implementing whatever is decided on is in agreement rather than being forced to do so. I mean, I do think that we've seen a lot of tremendous strides. But I also think that it's important to remember that we've seen these tremendous strides only after the population cap was ordered. And so that I think the population cap has been really instrumental in getting the state to deal with its overcrowding process.
Well, thank you. We're going to have to leave it there. You just heard from David Ball, who's an assistant professor of law at Santa Clara University. He's also co-chair of the Corrections Committee of the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section. We've also been speaking with Jeffrey Callison, who's the press secretary at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Thank you both. And Diana Zuniga is statewide organizer for Californians United for a Responsible Budget. We'll put information about all of their ideas on solving California's prison overcrowding crisis at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments there about what you think is the solution. Thanks to everybody who called. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How is the Affordable Care Act affecting your health coverage? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the implementation of Obamacare. President Obama gave the clear message that Americans who were happy with their health plans could keep them. But now millions of people are receiving letters of cancellation from their providers because their plans don't meet the ACA requirements. So what has been your experience with the Affordable Care Act, and what do you want to know about how it works in California? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.